Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem kleinen Theater-Podcast für Damen und Herren, die mal wieder einen richtigen Bleifuß haben. Wenn man etwas mexikanische Musik hier im Hintergrund hört, dann liegt es daran, dass ich diese Episode in einem Motel in San Francisco aufnehme. Ich bin nicht mehr in New York, trotzdem heute die letzte Folge, vorerst letzte Folge aus New York, bevor es weitergeht mit den Gesprächen in Chicago. Das heutige Gespräch ist quasi ein Geschenk an mich selbst. Es gibt wenige Cast-Alben, die ich mehr gehört habe als Teenager, als die beiden Versionen von The Wild Party, die 1999-2000 in dieser Saison parallel am Broadway und am Off-Broadway liefen. Beide Shows basieren auf einem Gedicht von Joseph Moncure March von 1928, so eine Art Jazz-Age-Poem, in dem eine Vaudeville-Tänzerin Queenie eine Party schmeißt, ziemlich alkohol- und sexlastig. Natürlich war dieses Gedicht ein Riesenskandal und genau das richtige Sujet für ein Broadway- bzw. ein Off-Broadway-Musical. Die Broadway-Version ist von Michael John Lacusa und George C. Wolfe, der ein Buch mitgeschrieben hat und Regie geführt hat, und war das Broadway-Debüt von Toni Collette als Queenie. Das ist, obwohl es am Broadway lief, die etwas sprödere Bearbeitung des Gedichts, akustisch deutlich ambitionierter als die Off-Broadway-Version, mit einer super tollen Eartha Kitt in einer der Nebenrollen, die einen alternden Showstar spielt und zwei Wahnsinns-Songs hat, einer davon When It Ends, aber ganz besonders toll Going Uptown. Beide Songs wurden extra für sie geschrieben und man wird sie wahrscheinlich nicht besser hören können als von ihr gesungen damals. Die Off-Broadway-Version von The Wild Party ist von Andrew Lipper, der das komponiert hat und das Buch geschrieben hat, und die ist sehr viel zugänglicher. Das Ganze lief am Off-Broadway, trotzdem sind einige Broadway-Namen dabei, vor allem Idina Menzel und als Queenie Julia Murney, die stimmlich der Wahnsinn ist und ein Timbre hat, das ich einfach damals sehr, sehr geliebt habe, besonders in der Nummer Raise the Roof, die sie eröffnet mit so etwas wie, ich paraphrasiere, ja, 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 ja. Und das habe ich total geliebt damals. Julia Murney wurde etwas später eine der ersten und am längsten spielenden Elphabas im Mega-Blockbuster Wicked, der ja nun auch gerade verfilmt worden ist. Sie hat das erst auf Tour gespielt und hat dann die Rolle am Broadway übernommen. Und das ist eine Rolle, die von der Kraftanstrengung und von der Athletik, die es dafür braucht, vielleicht zu vergleichen ist mit Richard Wagners Isolde in der Oper. Und auch was die Erwartungshaltung der Fans angeht, die sich fragen, kommt der entscheidende Ton? Das ist in Wicked zum Beispiel so etwas wie das Ende von dem Song Defying Gravity. Das ist der Song vor der Pause. Elphaba fliegt in die Höhe und stößt nochmal ihren Warcry, ihren sogenannten Warcry aus. Alles fragt sich, kriegt sie diesen Ton? Dieses Schweben wird übrigens mit einer Hydraulik gemacht, die eigentlich für Kirschernte benutzt wird. Also ist ein Cherrypicker auf eine Art. Ich erwähne das, weil Julia Murney davon auch in dem Interview spricht, nur dass klar ist, worauf sie sich dann da bezieht. Das ist diese Hebevorrichtung in dieser letzten Szene vor der Pause. Seit diesem Turn in Wicked ist Julia Murney von amerikanischen Bühnen nicht mehr wegzudenken. Zuletzt spielte sie an der Seite von Kathleen Turner in Stephen Sondheims A Little Night Music und fängt langsam auch an, ein bisschen zu inszenieren. Zuletzt It's a Good Man, Charlie Brown. Ich habe mich wahnsinnig gefreut, dass ich sie in New York treffen durfte und dass sie sich Zeit genommen hat. Und alleine jetzt ihre Stimme zu hören beim Schneiden dieser Episode, da konnte ich es eigentlich immer noch nicht fassen, dass ich sie tatsächlich getroffen habe. Ich spreche mit ihr über ihr Leben als Musical- und Broadway-Performerin, den Höchstleistungssport Wicked und ihre Sicht auf Theater. Und auch hier ein ganz spezieller Tonfall, wie man ihn vielleicht von anderen oder von deutschen Theaterschaffenden so nicht gewohnt ist. Ich sage mal, es lebe die Selbstironie. Ein großer Dank geht wiederum raus an das Goethe-Institut in New York, wo ich mich mit ihr treffen durfte. Und auf geht's, lift the cherry picker, sag ich mal. Viel Spaß beim Gespräch mit Julia Murney. So I'll probably ask you first, like, how did you come in contact with theater?
My father is an actor.
Okay.
I grew up here. I grew up in Manhattan.
Okay, well, okay.
One of those weird people who grew up here. And my father, he did two Broadway shows when I was very little, two Broadway musicals.
Okay.
And he's not really a singer. He can sing, but he's not a singer. And one of them was a musical called Mac and Mabel by Jerry Herman, which was Bernadette Peters and Robert Preston.
Oh, yes.
And it was his sort of flop, Jerry Herman's flop, in the middle of his run of Hello, Dolly! And later on La Cage. This was in the early 70s. So I was very, very little.
Yeah.
I think it was the book that just, it's a good score. There's good music in it. And then he was also in, was in a musical called Tricks. It's a Commedia dell'arte play. And he also did, he did a television show. We were in Los Angeles for 2 years and he did movies and some commercials and stuff. And then he got really into voiceovers, advertising voiceovers. And because there was a time when voiceovers, if you got in there, if you were able to catch the wave and you worked, it was absolutely a way to make a living.
Yeah.
Advertising in America is dead now. It's a lot of it has gotten non-union. It's all this other stuff. But he was really lucky to get in on that. And then by virtue of him, I got in on that. I rode his coattails in.
Yeah.
But honestly, I think once he started doing that, I mean, he was Shakespeare. He did Shakespeare. He was an actor. But I think he lost the passion for it. And when you compare having to do 8 shows a week or going into a recording booth for 45 minutes and then you just get checks in your mailbox for years sometimes, this is easier, you know? It's just...
Yeah.
And
so you knew theater?
So
like
I knew theater.
Childhood.
I went to theater. I can remember... he directed something. And I remember one of the actors, it wasn't my dad, one of the actors at one point, it might have been Shakespeare or something, they get pushed off this little bridge. And then he came up and he spat water. And I remember the actor showing me, little me, where the cup of water and the straw was for him to get pushed off the bridge and then take the water in his mouth so he could spit it. And I wasn't like, what? I thought it was, I was fascinated. I was like, oh, that's how that works. That's so interesting. And little things like that, but I was not a child actor. I did not ask to be a child actor or anything like that. And
what kind of music did your parents listen to? Like, with what kind of music did you grow up? Also like Broadway musicals?
Oh, we had, you know, it was a different era. You know, back then, Broadway cast albums, it was sort of, I think, going out by the time, like in the 70s, but certainly the 70s was the last gasp of it, where sometimes Broadway songs went onto the pop charts. Yeah. It was, you know, like it was part of the vernacular. And certainly back then, I mean, Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, they covered Broadway songs all the time. And so we had some, honestly, the very first cast album I ever knew was Jacques Brel Is Alive and Well and Living in Paris. Totally appropriate for, you know, a 4-year-old to be running around singing. But that's what my parents had. They had that cast album. I knew Annie because that was an American law.
Yeah.
If you were a little girl of a certain age in 1970, whatever year that was, you knew Annie, regardless of whether you cared at all about theater. But I liked theater. My mom and I would go to the discount theater place just on a whim sometimes and go see a Broadway show or whatever. And then when I was in high school, my parents made me go to a summer camp, and it was a theater camp. Well, they just said, I wasn't old enough to get a job, but they were like, you cannot hang around the city again this summer. You have to go to camp. And I didn't want to go to camp. I was singing at that point. I had joined the choir in my junior high, my middle school. So I really liked singing, but I want to be an actor. I wasn't there. Sometimes I think, though, if my father had been a pharmacist, I would have been like, I guess I could be a pharmacist because that's what I know. I knew actors. That's what I grew up with. So they ended up sending me to this theater camp that blew my mind. And the kids there were very intense. They were not like, I was very much odd man out. They were...
Tomorrow.
Yeah, they were that. They also had managers, a lot of them. They had headshots already. They were ready. Many of them had already worked professionally. It was wild. And I was like, yeah, hi. but there was a language that we all spoke of loving musical theater. And I can very distinctly remember... This was back when you could second act Broadway shows, meaning you snuck in at intermission.
Yes.
You really can't get away with that so much now.
I did it in Berlin years ago.
Yeah. Is it also still hard in Berlin, do you
yes.
think now?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
not still, but yeah. hard now? Yeah. It's yeah. Times have changed.
Yeah.
But this was back when you could do that. And the show that made me go, wait, what? Dreamgirls.
You did see the original?
Yep.
Oh my God.
Many times. Once for real the whole way, but act two, many times. And I always would get very scared that we would get in trouble and we would get kicked out, or like it would go on our, I don't know, we'd be arrested by the usher police. I don't know what we thought was going to happen, what I thought was going to happen. But my friends would be like, come on, come on, come on, we're going to do it.
But is, I'm telling you, is it second act or first
act? No, that's first act.
Oh, God.
I'll tell you what second act, though. Yes, the Jennifer Holliday of it all. My God, my God, my God. Loretta Devine, who played Laurel, singing, I don't know how well you know the show, but she has a song called Ain't No Party. That was the one where I, because she's kind of the meek one. And she doesn't get in the fights and she lets the other two fight it out and all this stuff. And she's in love with this man who's a huge star and has a wife, but keeps saying he's going to leave her and all of this stuff. And one day, finally, she snaps and she sings Ain't No Party to him. And because I second acted it so much, watching this audience, frankly, of sort of white businessmen from New Jersey whose wives were like, I would like to see Dreamgirls. You know, but all of them losing their minds for her, being like, yes, yes, you tell, like they would start screaming like on her side. It was so thrilling. And also the other thing that I never understood until Dreamgirls, oh, a director made this. I don't know what I don't know how I thought shows got made, like just magically from the baby Jesus, just like yeah. Whatever, but understanding that somebody, who Michael Bennett in that case, it was the transitions. The transitions in Dreamgirls are famous for how wildly good and seamless and useful they are. And it was the first time I'd ever noticed it.
How old were you by then?
I was probably, you'd have to look up what year Dreamgirls opened. I was in high school, for sure. I went to camp, that camp, the summers of 83, 84. So I want to say it was probably right in there, or it may be 85, but it was right in there somewhere.
Yeah.
For Dreamgirls. So that made me 14, 15, 16.
Okay. Ish. Yeah. And when did this decision happen to, oh, I want to study this, I want to do this professionally?
It's interesting. I don't recall, there wasn't a light bulb or a bing or anything like that.
How did you get all this? You know, there's this triple threat thing in America.
Like, yeah.
How did you? I think,
but no. To me, a true triple threat in the definition in terms of musical theater is this woman, Robin Herter, who is playing the lead in Smash right now. She is a true triple threat because she is an extraordinary dancer and she can sing her face off and she's a really good actor. That's the triple threat. Now, as it, I think was originally was the definition. I can move well. I am naturally, or I was anyway, naturally very flexible. So I could kick up to my face. That fools a lot of people. One really good kick to your face and they're like, you're a great dancer. I'm like, mm-hmm. Yes, yes, I am. No, I am not. But what I discovered very quickly was if you surround me by actual great dancers.
You look like one.
Exactly that. So, I mean, that's what I did in Wild Party. I was surrounded by extraordinary dancers and I danced enough. I could keep up with them to a degree and then would just drop off and go and do something else.
But did you took dance lessons also like before
I took dance lessons in college when I went to university.
Okay.
Which I did go to university for musical theater, which sounds ridiculous.
Why?
Because it is. It's ridiculous. What are you getting? I got a degree in musical theater. What? That's not useful. Anyway.
How long was that? Like 2 years or something?
4 years. I went to Syracuse University, which is in Syracuse, New York, which is upstate, about 5.5 hours from here.
Okay.
That camp, going to that camp really sent me in that direction, for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
I played Anita in West Side Story at that camp. I also played Mazeppa, the stripper with the trumpet from Gypsy.
Yes.
I was 14. That's not appropriate. Do you understand me? But that's what that camp did because...
Somebody had to do it.
I also played one of the cell block girls in Chicago.
In the camp?
In lingerie. I mean, it was... to look back on it, what is wrong with everyone? But listen, it was the 80s. This is how it went. This is the situation. Just go with it. Oh, and we did. It was sort of a natural progression, but not a very... As an adult, I have friends who, when I hear about their growing up, they did shows all the time. They did all the shows in high school. They did all that stuff. I went to the high school the movie Fame is based on.
Yeah.
So everybody's talented. It was a different vibe than the theater kids. Everybody was an artist of some kind.
Yeah.
And that school has visual art and dance and instrumental and acting and voice. I was a voice major. So once I got into high school, between going to that high school, that school, and going to that camp, it sort of just became arts all the time.
I mean, it probably a long jump to come to Broadway then. Mm. No? After studying, it took some. How long did it take
for me?
Yeah,
I didn't make my Broadway debut. It was one of these things where people get confused because, and when I say people, I mean people who are like deep dive musical theater fans. Like that guy in that office over there does not know and doesn't care. But if you're a musical theater fan, from the time when it happened, sometimes people forget that the Wild Party was not on Broadway. Well, there was one on Broadway because there were two.
I know.
But they were on and we were off. But because it was such a thing at the time.
It feels like Broadway.
People forget that. Yeah. And the cast was all eventually like Broadway people and all that. And then I also did several of these big one-night concerts for the Actors Fund, which were these huge, they were all on a Broadway stage. And one was Funny Girl, where there's a different Fanny Bryce in every scene.
Yes.
And women who would never play Fanny Bryce, myself.
I know the clips.
Lilias White.
Yes.
Yes. That's
iconic.
Trust. Iconic. And forget about it when it was live. It was truly, I will never see anything like this in
probably
my entire life.
Yeah.
It is, she's my favorite. So there was people, there was hair, and there was Chess. And Chess was me and Josh Groban and Adam Pascal and Sutton Foster.
And you still haven't technically been on Broadway.
Correct.
How did they find you? Why did they cast
those
you?
Concerts came after Wild Party.
Okay.
So they knew who I was and people knew who I was. But I still, if you want to be technical, which you can be, I had never been on Broadway.
Yeah, okay.
And then I made my Broadway debut in 2005. So I was 15 years out of college. And it was a show called Lennon, about John Lennon.
Famous
as opposed
flop.
To
no.
about
famous, flop.
Famous flop. Well, not famous flop, because no one knows it existed.
Just a flop.
So it's just a flop. Just a plain old flop. infamous flop, I guess.
Yeah.
And it was a bummer. I've only done two Broadway shows. I've done Lennon and Wicked. So I've been in a big, big flop. That we opened and closed very quickly. And then this huge hit that's a juggernaut that is still running to this day, 21 years later.
How long did you do Wicked?
All told, I did it for a year and a half. I did tour and then I did Broadway. But I will say, to be fair, during the time prior to me doing Lennon, because, like I said, I had gotten into voiceovers, like my dad, I was making a living doing that. Which meant I had my insurance doing that. I don't know if you're aware that the healthcare in America is, shall we say, not good. No bueno. Or how would we say not good in German? How do we say that?
Nicht gut.
Nicht gut.
Schwierig. Difficult.
Schwierig. Yeah. Because it's bad. But I had all of that. So I actually was offered. I had several offers to do Broadway shows that I turned down.
Okay.
Which sometimes people were very scandalized by.
But you didn't need
it was
to
just
money-wise because
right,
you had this other
right. And so it came down to, I don't... one of them was a show that I did that was transferring to Broadway, but I already had another job off-Broadway in a show that meant a lot to my heart. So, and we had already recorded the album before for the show number one. So I was like, I'm on the album. I won't do it. And I was supposed to be in a musical that came from Germany, Dance of the Vampires.
Oh, my God.
Yep. I was supposed to be in the Broadway cast, original Broadway cast. of Dance of the Vampires.
I saw the original in Vienna.
Dance to Vampire. Yeah.
It was actually not that bad.
I will
but
tell
I think
you
they did something here on Broadway, something crazy.
They did. They totally. I'm not sure how long ago this was. It might have been 7 years ago. I did a cruise for Playbill.
Yeah.
And it was a river cruise on the Danube.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a night in Vienna, and I brought my mom, and we were walking around. It's still playing.
Yes.
Because I was like, oh my God.
Yes.
It's just, I took a picture of it. I mean, we...
But it's like super, I read the reviews from here back then. I don't know what they tried to do here.
I mean, I think probably per what we were saying before, the, what's the word? The attitude of the audiences are very different.
Yeah.
Austrian, German to American. And I think, they tried to, I actually thought they didn't go far enough. They should have just kept going into the comedy.
Into the camp?
Yeah.
Okay.
And...
Not like halfway, like...
Yeah, but it also... I can't remember, honestly, who wrote... I don't remember who wrote the book.
But you didn't...
I mean, Jim Steinman wrote the music. I know that, but...
You didn't end up in
anyway,
the show.
I quit. I was in it, and right... We did a pre-production with just the principals, maybe 2 months before rehearsals were to begin.
Yeah.
And I had this terrible... I've never had this before. We sat at the... Did a reading the first day, and... While we were reading through it, I felt like the temperature in my body change. And I was like, uh-oh, I've made a mistake. I don't want to do this. And I truly thought it was going to run because Michael Crawford, it was his first show back after being the Phantom.
Yeah.
And he's very famous.
Yeah.
I thought he would make it, it would run just on him.
Yeah.
Alone.
It didn't.
It didn't.
And you were playing Magda?
Yep. The bar slut. Yes. Oh, yes. Indeed. Good call. You're probably the only one who might have pulled that up really quickly like that. But so I could have made my Broadway debut prior, but I didn't. And every time that I, like when I left that show, they were incredibly kind. Because it was also a thing where I had talked to them about, she didn't have a song. She has a little duet. And I talked to them about maybe her having a song. And they were really, really lovely about Jim Steinman. Rest his soul. But that he actually said to me, I would love to write that song for you. I was like, oh my God, shut up, sir. What?
I think in Germany she has a song.
Well, she has a duet.
Oh, okay.
Maybe it's different. I don't know. But then they didn't write it by the time we did that pre-production.
Okay.
And it also became very clear to me when we read that script that day. Oh, Magda the bar slut getting her own song is not important.
It's not
there are some huge fixins that need to be done in here, and this is not one of
the
them.
The bar slot is not one of them.
Nah. And so I recognized that. And so they were incredibly kind when I bailed. I wrote letters, and I wasn't sure how they would be received, and I just said, thank you for that opportunity, and I'm sorry, whatever.
Yeah.
But they were pretty cool. The several times that I did that I said no to doing a Broadway show, I became at peace. I was like, you know what? If you say no to this, you may never be in a Broadway show. I was not living in the confidence of, oh, I'll be in one someday. I did not. I don't know if I'll ever be in one again sitting here right now.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I know I don't want to do this. So I'm going to be at peace. It's my job to be at peace with saying no.
Yeah.
Because I'm the one saying no. I'm the boss of myself right now.
Yeah.
And then Lennon came along, which actually was truly a lovely experience, with the exception of when no one came. Yeah. that part wasn't so lovely.
Tell me a little bit about Wicked. Like, how is it doing this monster of a show? I always compare it to, like, maybe singing Tristan and Isolde, Richard Wagner every night.
But you know what it is? I've done shows. I sang more. In the Wild Party.
Yeah.
I sang more when I played Eva Peron in Evita. Now, Evita, it was summer stock, so I did eight shows. Done. Wild Party was a run. The thing that gets you vocally in Wicked is the screaming. And the amount of energy. The thing about Queenie in the Wild Party is that she's sort of like a flat line. She's sort of smooth, and then every once in a while she has these jumps or dips. And then tries to go back to smooth. But her way of dealing with all the chaos around her is trying to be cool. Elphaba is like, oh, 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 from the second, because she's mad and she's being forced to do things she doesn't want to do. And she's yelling at Fiero and she's yelling at monkeys and she's yelling at Nessa. And that's the stuff that takes you out.
Yeah.
And the three big songs in Wicked, Wizard and I, Defying Gravity, No Good Deed, all end at the same point. They end in the same kind of three notes. They end the way they end. It's not like you can do an alternate. You don't do an alternate end of Defying Gravity. You do the end of Defying Gravity. There's a little bit of flexibility in the war cry, but not a lot.
No.
And you can't go, you cannot do that. That's not one of the options. Just an octave drop.
Yeah. I opt down.
Yeah, just like, thank you. But just with a lot of intensity. No, this is not an option for you.
Yeah.
I talk to a lot of the girls who go in now, sometimes they get sent to me by other friends. I'm like, hey, my friend just booked Alphabet. Can she talk to you? I'm like, yep, send her my way. Because I know that I can at least give them some tips or whatever to go, you're not crazy. You're going to feel by about month four, you're going to be like, wait, what is happening? You're not crazy. That's what this role does. It's okay. And
why is this moment of like, you think you're going crazy? Because it's so much, do you?
It's so much, I think, because there's also this added part of the show itself. When I did Wicked, there was no social media. That's how long ago I did Wicked.
Yeah.
I think there might have been Facebook. I was never on Facebook, but there was no Twitter. There was no Instagram. There was certainly no TikTok. There was none of that. And to which I say, thank God. And even then, there's a pressure on that show.
I wanted to ask that.
Yeah, there's a pressure on it that's not written down anywhere. It's just there. And the fans in my time were so rabid. They just loved it so much. And in the same way that Rent in its day, they had such like huge fans, and Rent was young and scrappy kids, young adults, living their lives in a really dramatic, frankly, operatic way. And young fans were relating to that. Wicked talks to anybody who has ever felt less than, who has ever not felt at some point less than. I think one of the magic moments of that show is that you could watch it and not really like it. But when we get to For Good at the end, if you don't feel something, you're probably dead inside. Because that song, I have sung that song. I sang it at a funeral, I sang it at a wedding, and I've sung it at a graduation. You can kind of put it into any,
that's right,
all of these situations where there's some sort of goodbye. And the fact that Schwartz wrote that song that you can take out of its own context and still make people go, oh. And sometimes, like, I understand, after I left the show, I did not want to sing Defying Gravity.
Ever again.
Ever again. Because, I don't know, my whole body was just like, please stop. And I would sing Wizard and I. I was like, I'm okay with Wizard and I. But mostly because...
It's also a great song.
It is a great song. My favorite song of her songs, of the three big songs, is frankly No Good Deed. But no one wants to hear that one for whatever reason. I don't know. It's also weird, out of context. It's so heightened and so insane. I was doing a lot of symphony concerts after I left the show. And I was doing Wizard and I, and then one of the symphonies insisted on Defying Gravity. Insisted so much so that I was going to have to like drop out of the concert if I wasn't going to. And I went, well, this is ridiculous, Julia. So I basically took Defying Gravity to lunch. And I was like, we need to be friends. Okay, how do we make friends with each other? And what I realized, to the point, is that the audience doesn't care that Wizard and I is maybe a better song in terms of structure or whatever. They want to be taken back to the moment when they were sitting in the theater and she flew in the air. That's it. That's all it's about. They're not looking at the structure of the song. They're not looking at the, I mean, yes, you can bring them along with your own storytelling, but that's what they want. They want to be taken back to that moment where they went, oh, and then they ran to the merchandise counter at intermission and bought things. That's where they want to be taken to.
Yeah.
And once I figured that out, I was like, oh, okay, you need to get over it. And you need to give these people, it's about them. It's not about me.
Does one have a life during Wicked?
Nah.
No.
Not just, really.
Like, not talking?
Yeah, every once in a while, there's a woman who does it, who ruins it for everyone else, because sometimes someone gets in there who's just, like, steel cords. And I said to Cola Scola, the last time I saw them in O'Mary, I've seen them do it twice, it was on Broadway, and afterwards I said, how are you doing here in your throat? And they were like, it's hard. It's really hard. I said, I understand. And you'll see why. I mean, it's very intense. And I said, okay, how are you doing with the part where you're now being asked to do all these really cool extracurricular things and you have to say no to a lot of them because you're too tired? And they looked at me and went, you know, I said, yes, I know. I know. And I know that's really frustrating, but I am here to tell you specifically, your special invitations are not going anywhere. Whenever you are done with this show, they are still going to want you come to their fancy parties or whatever. It's okay. But there were plenty of things that I said, yes, oh, I'll do that on a night off. And we got toward the night off and I was like, I cannot do that. I can't. It would have been irresponsible. Even if I could have done it, I wouldn't have been in the show on Tuesday night. And the show's my job. Yeah. You know, I have to do my job if I can. So yeah, it's tricky. It's a lot of rest. It's a lot of just being quiet, and which makes it lonely. And my boyfriend at the time, he was in a show called Curtains, and he's a dancer. And we would go home, and his feet would be in buckets of ice, and I would be writing on a dry erase board. I'm like, we are a sexy couple. Look at this. Broadway, everybody.
But what do you think makes it like worthwhile? What is it at being in a Broadway show? Because when I see it, I think it must be fun also to do this. Mm. But apart from that, what do you like, or what is the fascinating part?
Do you mean specifically Broadway or just theater in general? Because I don't.
Maybe if it's two different things, maybe you can do a two-part answer.
I think the truth of it is that it is a two-part answer, because one part is there's no difference. I don't work less hard when I'm doing Donna in Mamma Mia at this theater called the Muni in St. Louis, where you do 8 shows, you rehearse for 10 days, you throw that thing up, and it's an outdoor amphitheater of 11,000 people a night. I work just as hard doing that as I do trying to do Wicked, for example. The difference, the immediate difference is most Broadway shows, unless they are limited runs, open with the intent of, we'll just keep this sucker running. And there is something about, like, to what you're asking, like, what happens at the fourth month or whatever, your body starts to go, hi, why do we keep doing the same thing? Why are we still doing this? And you're like, and your body starts to go, no, I'm sitting down. You can't make me.
I don't want
to
do this. Okay.
And it happens to dancers. It happens to singers. It happens to actors. Your brain's not made to do. Someone may work in an office, or even someone actually more to like on an assembly line, let's say for a car maker or something, and they kind of do the same thing over and over again. But if you get mindless about it and you stop concentrating, there could be some sort of mistake on your part on the assembly line in the factory. If you get mindless about it on stage, because your body's like, oh, I don't want to do it, you suddenly will forget your line. You will forget the line that you have said so many times. And the second your brain starts to go, oh, shoot, I need to get milk and I need some juice. Oops, that was my line. Wicked specifically, when you're carrying the load of that role and the specter of that role, who she is, the mail that I would get sometimes, multiple pages, double-sided, handwritten, going in and talking about their lives, being bullied, just telling me about themselves. And all of a sudden at one point, it was saying, that's when I started cutting myself. And I'm like, oh no, I'm not qualified. I don't know. And I want this person to be okay. But I was very aware that if I put too much of myself into that person, that was also not going to be useful, because they're then going to be like, oh, you're going to save me, Julia. I'm like, nope, Julia's not saving you. That's not.
I'm a clown.
Right. I would always write back. And in situations like that, I would always say things like, either I promise you, you're going to find your people or whatever. Or sometimes I would say, if you can, go to your parents and talk to them. And if you can't go to your parents, go to one of your teachers. And if you can't go to your teacher, you can find someone that you know. But I always left it like over here.
Yeah.
That's that role. That's a very specific thing. I think fan mail that's sent to Audra playing Mama Rose is sent to Audra. It's not sent to Mama Rose going, please tell me what to do with my life because she's crazy.
Could you please think of an act for me?
Exactly.
Should I use the cow?
Uh-huh. but Elphaba represents this thing of the underdog who everyone is mean to. And in the end, she's the most powerful one. She gets the boy. She's the winner, even though she's exiled. Even though her boyfriend is now a scarecrow. Like, it's, there are some challenges, but generally, she's the winner.
Yeah.
And even though she's been othered, even though she's been the not enough. And so these young people, most specifically, and now those young people who saw it when I was in it are grown, and many of them have children, and they are forcing their children to go see Wicked now because they're like, you love it. Like, I loved it. Not many shows run as long as Wicked has run. It's in year 21 right now.
What do you say, like, if I would tell you, like, in Germany that art and entertainment is quite separate?
Mm.
Do you have any idea about this? I mean, it's completely different here. Or
do you feel it's that way sort of across the board in Germany, the entertainment and art? Is there ever art considered entertainment?
That's the question.
That's definitely the Broadway focus, because Broadway is commercial theater.
Yeah.
Broadway is capitalism with jazz hands, but it's still capitalism. The bottom line is they are trying to make money. People are putting money in to try to make money back in the most simplistic of forms. Sometimes there are shows that are done where potentially they know they may not make their money back, but they do it for
tax reasons
to honor the writer, who is a very whatever, who's passed, or like a Sondheim or a, but in general, now the definition of entertainment, I mean, right now on Broadway, so there's a show running right now on Broadway called Anne Juliet, and it's all music of Max
Martin.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So it's pop. It is bubblegum. The show is very silly. It's very well done. Silly. Because I think there's room for silly. I really do. I don't mind if you've done it really cleverly. And I think that show does it pretty well, pretty much better than any other show of its type that I've seen. And when I went to see it, and there's confetti cannons that have gone off at the number, and people are clapping, and I leaned over to my friend, and I went, and two blocks away, Death of a Salesman. That's awesome. That's awesome that Broadway is that.
Yeah.
That Broadway is this serious, beautifully acted classic play, and Anne Juliet, and Wicked, and Othello, and whatever. I mean, it's if the definition of entertainment is like light and frothy and makes you laugh. That's not every show on Broadway, but there's some sort of heightened emotion that I think audiences look for specifically in a Broadway show, whether that emotion is laughter, tears, oh, I never thought of that, like that kind of thing. Oh, I feel frightened. I don't know what's going to happen, whatever that is, as opposed to what we would call like downtown stuff, which is sounds more like German, like the Pina Bausch of it all.
Yeah.
That the downtown stuff here is stuff that is, look, no show is going to be everybody's cup of tea, regardless of where they're
also
doing
Wicked
it.
Is not
everybody's no. cup of tea. No, not at all.
Yeah.
I have some notes, frankly. But the downtown stuff is, it's much more raw because it doesn't have the money behind it. It doesn't have the capability of the set design, the lighting design, the sound design, all of that stuff, the most sophisticated of that is on Broadway.
Yes.
Because it's the most expensive.
Yeah.
And so...
Do you feel, while you're acting, do you feel the money?
Honestly, no, that's a really good question.
Do you feel the pressure of the money behind you?
You don't feel the pressure of the money in the moment, like as you're going. I feel that sometimes the pressure that you can feel is especially like Broadway-wise, if you're doing a new show, previews of a Broadway show are not for the faint-hearted. You are exposed, especially now with the social media, because these people who go on these little chat boards and say whatever the hell they want to say, not even using their real name. Like, if you're going to say that, use your name.
Yeah.
Don't call yourself whatever, Tour Boy 69. George Smith, you tell me your name, George.
Yeah.
If you're going to, I mean, I don't read them, but because it's dangerous. It's very exposing. Once you start previews, you're doing the show at night and you're rehearsing in the day. And you're often unless you're doing a revival. But even if you're doing a revival, you are doing change, like staging changes.
Edits or cut down.
Yeah. If you're doing a brand new show, I mean, Wild Party, I remember during previews, there was a day I had a change of some note, like a little or big, whatever, in every single scene in the show. And at the end of the show, I had a brand new song that I had learned that morning. I was only 30, so my brain was fresh. My brain was like, yep, got it. Very much concentrating.
That's a pressure.
But that's pressure. And that wasn't even on a Broadway scale, especially now. I mean, Broadway shows cost millions and millions of dollars. There's not one person producing it. Look at the front page of, you're seeing Oh Mary Tonight?
No, Sunset.
Oh, seeing Sunset. Okay. I'm sure Sunset's the same. Look at the front page inside of for the show in the playbill.
Yeah.
Look at the number of names that are above the title. Those are all of the producing entities. Some of those producing entities are actually a bunch of people who all get together, put their investment into a pool, and that pool is called whatever. All of those people, not all of those people, the people who are at the top, literally listed, those are the lead producers. They have a say. They can come into rehearsal and be like, I really don't like that sweater, or I really don't like that song, or I really don't like that actor, or I really don't like whatever. And they have to be regarded. They're putting millions with an M of dollars into this thing to make it go. So sometimes the shows end up being what I call a meatloaf show, not the singer, but the dish, which is meatloaf is just basically what's in the fridge. I don't know what that, but it becomes like a meatloaf show because they're like, we have to cut that because blah, blah didn't like that. And we have to put that person in the show because blah, blah's cousin, whatever.
Yeah.
And really once you've started previews, even though you're making changes, you're in, you're done. It's so expensive to try to make massive changes on a Broadway scale while you're in previews. There is something sometimes very moving about quote unquote downtown art because they are telling story just using this cup, this brolly, and a piece of tinfoil. And they're making art and they're telling you a story. The higher up the capitalism rank that you go, which the highest is a Broadway show, there's so much money on the line. And you can feel the stress as an actor sometimes. Just perfume coming off of the director, the choreographer, the producers, the writers. You're like, oh my God, I'm choking on your anxiety. I'm trying to remain calm, but holy cow, get away from me. Because they're all freaking out because they see something different.
But doesn't that make you freak out? Also?
Yes, yes. So basically it's a building of people attempting to not freak out. And then one of them will lose their minds and like throw something. That's where I feel like you feel the money negatively. Where you feel the money positively as a performer, if you're lucky, is being in a show in which there is care being taken. I mean, Elphaba, you have a dedicated dresser. You have one human being who follows you the whole show for any of your needs, who also helps change you and all that stuff. But hands you water, hands you a lozenge, hands you a spray, gives you a tissue. Like, I had never had that before. Yeah. And when I got in there, I remember I would have something in my hand and I would look for somewhere to put it down and she'd be like, I got it.
It stressed me out.
It totally stressed me out. And at first I fought it. And I was like, no, I got it. I'm okay. And then I thought, So she's been here longer than you. I was the fifth person. She has served four other women in this capacity. This is, and she understood, even between myself and my understudies, we had different, like, there's a bag that you wear for a lot of Act One, and I like mine this way. The other girl might like it on the other shoulder. And it was her job to remember that for the quick change when she puts the bag on you.
Yeah.
Little things like that. Or I liked water at this time and somebody else liked water at a different time. And she would just remember those things and clock them away. But after a while, I just let her take care of me.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
it's what she's there for.
And also it's a draw.
But it's something to get used to.
Yeah.
And some shows, they'll set up, rightfully so, they will set up physical therapy. A show like Wicked, you get a facial because you're green and it yeah. kind of can wreak havoc. Not really, but it can. And that's all money.
Yeah, and also you can see it on stage because in a thing like Death Becomes Her is like the craft and the everything is taken care of.
Yeah.
It's just like there's no loose ends or there's
And it's
no...
still live theater, right?
Yes,
and
yes,
and things still go wrong. And sometimes the levitator does not work at the end of Act 1.
The cherry picker.
The cherry picker, correct. And when that happens, it's pretty devastating because you're like, this is a pretty big moment. Oh, well, I can't fix it. Sometimes the beds in Popular, I remember sometimes one of them would get stuck in its track and not go off. And this one would go off and this one's just like, kr-kr-kr-kr. And you keep going. It takes, someone has to be...
injured?
Or like in danger of being injured.
Okay.
Or something where... Oh, a whole scene from now, we will not be able to move forward if that's not off the stage. That's when they'll hold.
Okay.
Or they'll hold for a sound issue if someone's microphones go out and you can't get them back. Like all those kinds of things. Downtown, often you figure it out. You knock that thing over and it just spilled everything everywhere and you make it part of the thing. And if you're really sick, there may not be understudies. Like it's scrappier. I think sometimes it's a little more from the heart because you're more involved in the actuality of it. In a Broadway musical, there's all of these people that make it go. It can't go without these crew people who move this stuff, that person on the spotlight, this entire pit of musicians. Like it's not as interesting if it's just me. Who cares?
Yeah.
It's only interesting because we're all there doing all these very high-end, show-off, fancy things.
Yeah.
Because it's Broadway. And it is fun. It's totally fun. It's also a job.
Yeah. In this political situation at the moment.
What? I don't know what you're talking about. I feel great. I feel great. Yes.
What do you think is the theater?
Ooh.
What is the role of theater at the moment? Or is there any role? Should it have some kind of role? Or it's a triggering question, probably.
Well, no, it's interesting because like my knee-jerk reaction is we should fight with everything that we have. And I think that is true regardless. Absolutely. That's the base. There is a part of me at this point, especially if I'm going to see something that takes place today, like innocuously right now, unless it is a political piece, sometimes shows right now will slip something in that we all know what you're talking about. You know, like we're talking about him or whatever. And there's a little part of me that's like, oh, I could have done without it. I don't need to think about him. Can I not have him for 2.5 hours? Not because I want a piece to placate to people who do want to talk about him and think he's great, like not for that reason, but just so I can have a break.
Mm-hmm. There were a few moments in Gypsy where they had this like a dance number and then the American flag was put together wrongly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, interesting. Did you think of that politically?
Yes.
That's so interesting. And maybe I didn't because I know that show so well, because I'll remind you, I played the stripper with a trumpet when I was 14, but I've also played Rose.
Okay.
That's so interesting. That didn't strike me as political because they are just dumb kids who are getting it wrong.
And then again, I was like, I found it like a good move. And at the same time, I'm like, it's creepy. Are we in a time where you have to be that subtle?
We're in a time that you took it as that.
Yes.
And I didn't.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I went to Washington, to D.C. a few weeks ago to see a show that some friends were in. And the first thing when you drive into D.C. from their place, the first thing that you see along the river is the Kennedy Center. Mm. And I really like D.C. I think it's cool to see the monuments and stuff. We don't have a lot of cities like that like you do in Europe that... you know, whether they got blitzed and bombed or not, like that have these sort of older structures and monuments and things like that. And DC is one of them. And it was, I felt so sad when I saw the Kennedy Center. And it doesn't look any different, but I can't unknow what I know that they are doing. And that part is really hard.
Or maybe the theater in itself is such an like utopian place. That you don't need like explicit like political.
I guess that's what I mean when I say, unless the show is political. If that's the bend of it, let's go.
Yeah.
Let's do it with great writing and sophisticated whatever it is. And I don't mean money, but I mean just like brain work on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I would like to go in and forget about, what does he say in Cabaret? Leave your worries outside. In here, life is beautiful.
Yeah,
the girls are beautiful. Even the orchestra is beautiful. Like part of me, I mean, and the brilliant thing about Cabaret, of course, is that the show is entirely political and is entirely about things dissolving.
Yeah.
And, but I sometimes as an audience member, Death Becomes Her is just that. I don't need anybody. I don't recall. There's nothing, right?
I don't think so.
Okay.
No, there isn't.
Sometimes I just don't need it in the same way, like in the movies. I can't see Oppenheimer and not think about politics. That was a political situation. I also thought that was a stunning movie. But I also just saw Black Bag with Cate Blanchett and Skarsgård.
Michael Fassbender.
One. And they're just gorgeous and spies. There's, I mean, it's political, but it's not. It's all like fairy tale.
Yeah.
And it was great. I'm happy for that too. I'm happy for art to be many things, definitely.
But what do you think is like the main thing that art is, or the most important part of it?
I mean, I do think the most important part of it is to allow whoever is coming to view it, experience it, whatever it might be, to feel a feeling, whatever that may be.